is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Well, listen, like, I'm just going to be honest, like, none of them have good enough socials for, like, anything national, but you're in Boston, why don't you go reach out to all the companies in the local area? I'm sure they're already sponsors at the court, they're already sponsors for banquets, etc. I'm sure they'd be glad to spend a few hundred, few thousand dollars. I mean, what if your guys all get free food for a year? That's just as good of an NIL deal, in my opinion, as getting cash.
Andrew Petcash is a sports entrepreneur and former Division I basketball player at Boston University. Andrew is on the founding team of the Air app, an exclusive social media matching app built to help athletes get discovered across the world. He created the Petcash Post, a newsletter breaking down the business of athletes and sports. It's read daily by athletes, coaches, sports professionals, and fans. The Petcash Post has become a go-to resource for more than 23,000 people. He's also the founder of College Athlete Insight, an educational website around college recruiting and NIL. Hey, Hoopheads, anything is possible this March with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Get a huge $2,000 trade-in discount on a new machine in March when you trade in any old Dr. Dish machine. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Stan Johnson, head men's basketball coach at Loyola Marymount University, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads mentorship program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at HoopheadsPod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Be prepared to take some notes as you listen to this episode with sports entrepreneur Andrew Petcash.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. Mike Plinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel, although Jason's mic, unfortunately, is not working, so we're hoping we're going to get that fixed so that we may be able to hear from Jason during this episode. But we are pleased to be joined by sports entrepreneur Andrew Petcash. Andrew, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Mike, thanks for having me on, brother.
Absolutely. We are excited to be able to have you on and talk some sports, talk some business, and I think it's going to be a really, really interesting episode for our audience to check out. So, let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid, dive into your bio a little bit. How'd you get into the game of basketball when you were younger?
For sure. Yeah. So I started real young. My dad, he played at Division III in college. And when I was like 3 years old, he started rolling me a ball. We had our basement. It was, you know, the cement and everything. Started dribbling around. We had the Tykes hoops. So I always used to be dunking on those. And then I started saying, hey, Dad, I kind of like basketball. You know, like this could be something. So he started taking me to University of Pittsburgh basketball games. And I remember sitting there, I don't know, 7, 8 years old and saying, Dad, like, I'm going to play college basketball one day. And that was kind of like our path from there. And you know, worked my way up, but that's kind of where it started, and we can go, you know, dive in somewhere else.
Did you have a favorite player growing up?
I love J.J. Redick.
Okay.
Love J.J. Redick. And I know he got all the Duke guys, they always get hated on, but he was a huge – I loved watching him just come off screens, and I know that's all debated now. Was it legal? Not legal, but, I mean, just to run around in that pure stroke. And he actually has a good podcast himself these days that I listen to every night.
Yeah, his podcast, he's really good. He's really good. He's going to end up, I think, probably, my guess is he ends up in a network studio show or doing games at some point. I think that's probably the direction he's headed, because, yeah, his pod's really good. And then, of course, obviously, with all the connections that he has, just gives you a really good opportunity to be able to get great guests. And he does an excellent job with what he's doing. And of course, had just an unbelievable career. Kind of got off to a slow start in the pros, and it looked like maybe he was going to just kind of become a journeyman, and really turned it around after a couple of years and became a guy who, would he play 15, 16 years in the league?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, had a great career. So you think about yourself growing up in Pittsburgh and coming up through the youth basketball ranks. What do you remember about your, let's say, your AAU experience as a young kid?
Man, AAU, I would, if you could say you could go back in time anywhere, I think AAU would be one of the first places I go. I mean, just not even just the plane either, the hotels and running around. And a lot of those guys, it's kind of wild looking back. Basically, my whole, so from like fourth grade to eighth grade, maybe ninth grade, we had the same team, same group of guys. And almost all of us, I think there was 8 out of the 10, all played a sport in college. And most at the highest level, but it was only like 2 of us that played basketball, which was pretty crazy to think about, because that was all our main sport at the time. But traveling, the hotels, just playing different competition. I mean, that was like, I wish there was AAU forever. That was the best type of basketball to me. I loved AAU. Like, high school was cool, college was cool, but AAU basketball, I mean, to me, if you're on the right team and you're good, and you go to, like, you have good group of guys and families, I mean, there's nothing better than that.
It really is, I think, one of those unique experiences that it's so different from, again, I'm an old guy, 52 now, and AAU, when I was playing, was just getting started. And so I spent much more time playing pickup basketball and not really much time playing AAU basketball. I certainly didn't travel and go to hotels and have those experiences like you had. I instead had time on the playground. So when you think about those times on the road with your teammates, do you have one particular memory that stands out? Maybe one on the court, one off the court, something that really sticks in your memory when you think back about that time with those guys?
Yeah, I think off the court, to start out, I remember, so there was a team 2 years older than us that we kind of traveled with, because there was a lot of the older brothers on that team. And one of the guys, his dad played at Pitt, and he, like, his whole family came, and he was a tall kid. I mean, sixth grade, whatever tall is for sixth grade, he was that. but there was a pool in the hotel, and it was a smaller pool, but we, like, all lined up, and he jumped. I mean, none of the parents saw it. I'm sure they would have freaked out at the time, but he jumped the entire pool, and I remember just being like, wow, like, there are some athletic kids out there, and that was my first, like, real taste of it. And then as you know, I mean, there's some dudes that can jump.
Yeah, you're like, hey, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, I was like, I'll shoot the ball from one end to the other, but I don't know about jumping all that far.
Absolutely.
And then on the court, there was this one team, the Cleveland. They changed their name, like, every year, but they always had, like, older guys, reclass guys. And I think they were like the Cleveland Warriors or Clue. I don't know. But we used to always play them in these championship games. Like, every year, there would be like 2 tournaments we're in, they're in, and we'd play in the championship game. And we could never beat them. And then finally, like, maybe the last year that we were all together, we beat them on the last game. And it was pretty cool. And actually, some of those guys on that team now, a lot of them went on to play college too. One of the guys, he plays on Ohio. I know another guy on, like, Cleveland State. So those are, like, the cool memories. Like, AAU basketball in general just sets you up in life. Even the people you play against, you know, it comes around, goes around, and then they're in your network and you become friends later on, which is always cool to me.
that is very cool, especially when you think about just how interconnected the basketball space is. When you think about, we often look at it from a coach's perspective, because a lot of times we're talking to coaches, but you're right when it comes to the player side of it as well, that, yeah, you grow up from the time you're fourth, fifth grade. If you're traveling and you're playing against other good teams, you're going to see a lot of those same kids. And again, after you see them over and over and over and over again, eventually you kind of get to know them. And again, you stay in touch, and now you've got them, as you said, as part of your network. When that team broke up, what was your process for finding a new team?
Yeah, it more so broke up because guys like myself, like, we realized that we needed a little more exposure. Like, we were a good team, but we were playing around Ohio, you know, Pennsylvania, West Virginia. And it was like, hey, we need to get to more of the tournaments now that we're in high school with a lot of coaches. And some of the guys, like, they were athletic, big guys, football players, but basketball wasn't their thing. And that's when it started to separate a little more. So it was more of like a personal decision where I was like, I need to get on a little better team. And then that team, it was like the same dynamic. We were really good, and everyone went on to play college, and we weren't a shoe league team, but we would beat the shoe league teams all the time that would come to the tournaments. So that was really fun. I loved playing on that team, especially.
Once you get out and you get into the tournaments that have more exposure, and you're walking around and you're seeing college coaches from different places, what do you remember about maybe the conversations that you and your teammates had? If you saw a coach like, oh man, I see this guy on TV, or there's whoever, what were those conversations like?
Yeah, when it first hit you, like, that's wild. Like, I remember I could barely, ninth grade, I could barely dunk. Like, it was my first time. I was like barely rim grazing. We had a bunch of coaches at the game, and I remember I was like getting up, and I was like a whole nother adrenaline going through me. And I think there was like Bob Huggins. There was all these guys. I mean, looking back, I probably, just based on how I played and my athleticism, I had no real chance to play there. But it was still really cool, right, to play in front of those guys that you see on TV all the time. And then eventually, by the time, you know, 3 years in, it's like nothing else, right? It's like seeing your teacher every day in class. You're just seeing coaches in the gym, which is good. And I don't think not every kid gets to experience that. And I think that's a big separator, is once you become normal and you don't a lot of people try to push it too hard, or they try to do stuff that it's not really their game when coaches are around. That always hurts them. And so if you get more, you get used to it, then you usually perform better. But
yeah, that's a great point. I think it's very easy if it's something that, as you said, is kind of a one-off that only happens once in a while. I could see where guys put a lot of pressure on themselves. Oh, I got to play well. Here's Coach X or Y sitting there, and I got to make sure that I'm playing well. I got to try to do maybe some things that are beyond my capabilities, versus if you kind of get used to that environment, you know the coaches are there, you've seen them there for a bunch of times, then it's no big deal, and you just start playing and you play the way that you've always played. When you think about the balance between, this is a conversation that we've had with coaches at all levels, and we're talking about how they evaluate players. And when you think about your experience, I'm guessing I know the answer based on where the conversation's gone to this point, but I want to ask the question anyway. When you think about your recruitment, how much do you think what you did as a high school player weighed against what you did in an AAU setting? In other words, did coaches say to you, hey, we've seen you in AAU, and that's really where we're evaluating you? How much did they look at what you did in high school? Just what was the balance between those two separate environments?
Yeah, I mean, AAU is everything, in my opinion. I think high school I want to take that back a little. If you want to play Division I, AAU is everything. But if you're fine at playing any other level, then high school, you know, has a little more impact. So I earned, I would say, one Division I offer from a coach from St. Francis, PA, which was a more local school, and the rest were D2, D3 from just high school. But from AAU, that's when I got like my, you know, other handful of Division I offers along with Division II as well. So, I mean, if you don't play AAU, I personally, in this day and age and time, I saw something with all these transfers. So my brother, he actually plays for Binghamton University, and they just lost last night to Vermont. But they beat New Hampshire the game before. And literally the next day after New Hampshire lost, their five starters hit the transfer portal. They're five starters. Like, we're not even talking about, like, they're five guys that don't play. They're five starters. So, like, if you're a high school player these days, okay, you might say, oh, now there's an opportunity at New Hampshire. Well, not really. They're probably going to bring in transfers. And now those five guys that have a ton of D1 experience, of course another D1 school is going to pick them up. Some of those guys, they were the number three seed in the America East, like, standing. So those are good guys, like, really good players. They're going to get picked up. So now the stat I saw is, like, 30% less spots for kids coming out of high school to play college basketball. And I'm not sure if that was Division I, all levels, et cetera. But, I mean, you have to play AAU if you want even a chance, in my opinion, to play at the highest level these days. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think you're 100% right. I think it's the extra year of eligibility has played havoc for high school kids, right? So that's one piece of it. And then the transfer portal is a whole other thing. We've talked about it, Andrew, where we've said, you know, it's not only – where you have play, like, you can have players going all directions, right? So it's not just, so let's say you have a kid who goes to a mid-major school. That kid, what's allowed mid-majors in the past to be good and make tournament runs is you get some kids who are under the radar, maybe they're late developing, whatever. For some reason, the bigger schools don't want them coming out of high school. Now that kid comes in, you develop them over the course of 4 years. And by the time that kid's a senior, maybe you have a class of, you know, 2, 3, 4 seniors and a couple juniors. And now suddenly you have an experienced team where you can go in and compete. And now kid goes to a mid-major school and averages 10 points a game as a freshman. The odds of that kid sticking around, I mean, I don't know what it is, but it's pretty low, right? I mean, that kid's going to probably go and play for a Power 5 school because that Power 5 school looks at the kid and says, he doesn't have to adjust to college. He doesn't have to adjust the academics. He doesn't have to adjust to being away from home. We already know he can go through a college season and be a good player. So you just eliminate whatever risk there is with a high school kid. You're basically eliminating that if you're taking a kid who's had success already at college basketball. And then I think you can also look at it and go the other way. So maybe now a kid who goes to a Power 5 school and doesn't have the amount of success that they think they should. Now those kids are moving down. And so then if you're a high school kid that's looking to go to a mid-major, well, maybe they're getting the 12th man from Michigan. And what do they need some high school kid when they got these other recruits? I just think that it's, as a college coach and trying to build a program and have continuity and basically what you're signing up for is you're just coaching a different team every year. It's like every year we're just running it back with a whole new set of guys. I think that's the mentality you'd have to have as a college coach.
Yeah. No, I agree. I guess the real question is then how do you get guys to stay? Like, how do you convince a mid-major player that's averaging, say, 12 points a game to stay an extra year? Or how do you convince the 12th man on Michigan to stay? Like, what approach do you take as a coach?
I think what you have to do is you have to build relationships and build the type of culture and build the type of overall experience that makes that kid want to stay. And there's probably a million things, right, that go into building the right culture and the right kind of experience so that that kid wants to stay. To me, a lot of it comes down to, I'd say the biggest piece of it is the relationship between the player and the coach. If you are a coach and you're not investing in your players, not only on the basketball floor and trying to develop them as players, because let's face it, today especially, if you're playing Division I basketball, most kids at some point are thinking that they're going to have an opportunity to play professionally, at least overseas, right? Most kids have that in their mind. If you're a Division I player, that's probably what you're thinking. So as a coach, I think one of your jobs is to develop them as players, but then I think the more important part of getting them to stick around is you got to have that relationship with them so that they know that you care about them off the floor. You've got to try to do everything that you possibly can to not bend over backwards to keep them happy, because that's the wrong way of saying it, but you have to be the type of coach and have the type of relationship that that player wants to be around you, wants to be around your program. And part of that goes to what kind of facilities does your program have? How much are you investing in things off the floor? What kind of fan base do you have? And those are all things that maybe the coach can't directly control. But certainly, I think as a coach, you've got to try to create the kind of experience that a player wants to stick around for. So think about yourself, right, with AAU. The guys that you played with, the families that were a part of that. So think about as a coach, like who's your staff? Who are the people that you're bringing in? Who are the other players? Does the player get along with it? There's so many things that go into it. And I think it's tough because everybody sees the grass is greener on the other side, but they don't always see that there's also problems no matter where you go. No matter where you go, nothing's ever going to be perfect. And I think in today's world, kids just are ready, and maybe even more than kids, parents are just ready to say, hey, you can get more over here than you can get there. I think that's the big issue.
Yeah. So when I was at Boston U, we only had one kid transfer, one undergraduate transfer. So I think like high academic schools with full rides, that helps too. Like kids didn't, I think on my team, there were certain guys that would have transferred, had like the piece of paper you get from going to Boston University, which when I was there was, I think, the number 42 best school in the country, according to whatever rankings. But like that holds guys in as well. So yeah, I think a lot of it is out of control, but if I'm in an athletic department, I'm thinking of every way to keep guys. Cause we had one of the kids on my team, he transferred in from Texas Tech. And I remember like we became really good friends, and a few of the conversations, he's like, wait, you don't have a cook make your food for you? Wait, you don't have golf carts to drive you around campus? You don't have, you know, saunas in the locker room? You don't have all, I'm like, I don't know any different, but like from coming down, I could see how that would be hard for someone like that. But the Power Fives have all the bells and whistles. So I can see why guys want to move up because they want to experience that at least for a year. And especially if you already got your degree, and that all comes back to that extra year, which that's going to have lingering effects for several years to come, most likely.
Yeah, that's going to take a while to kind of run its way through the system before things get back to quote unquote normal, which I'm not sure what normal looks like moving forward. But all I know is as a college coach, it's got to be extremely challenging. And I think when you look at this, what's interesting is there's always been that complaint, right, that coaches can pick up and leave whenever they want to, and there's no penalty. They didn't have to sit out a year the way players previously had to sit out a year if they transferred. And so there was always that backlash of, why don't players have the same rights? And now that players have the same rights, look, there's certainly something positive to be said for, right? You go to a situation, the coach leaves, the situation isn't what you thought it was. You're not locked in there. You're not having to go and transfer and then spend a year just being a practice dummy and not getting to play in games. There's certainly something positive to be said for that. And yet the downside of it is that when you have guys just jumping around everywhere, look, it makes sense for some guys, but I think I'd be curious, let's say we do a long-term study 5 or 10 years from now after you really have some data points about how much benefit there was to guys that went through and transferred. I think you're right when you talk about the grad transfers. To me, that makes a ton of sense. I mean, that's clearly, I think, a huge positive. But I'd be curious to see guys who transfer as undergrads, what that really looks like, both in terms of their basketball career and in terms of what they end up doing academically as well.
No doubt. And I think this, and I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but like leading into NIL even, I mean, it's only going to get worse in terms of numbers of transfers. I think there was like 17 or 1800 last year, and this year will probably be over 2000 for sure, without a doubt. And now you're going to have guys that say they're at, I don't know, I'll pick a random school, SMU, solid, I think it's the American Conference, right under Power Five. Say you average 12 points a game, but you don't really have any NIL activity. And then there's, I don't know, Kentucky, Michigan State, whatever. They have some collective, or they have something where they can be like, hey, we can get you 70K next year. And this stuff happened, obviously, beforehand, but under the table. And now it's just all brought to light. But like, now players are going to be like in a free agency type setting where they're leaving. They're going, hey, I did my time. I've had two good years at SMU. Now let me go, pick my options.
It's the James Harden of college basketball.
That's right. Hey, Jason, you're on.
What's up, Jason? Got the microphone to work.
All right, good.
We love James Harden on this podcast, Andrew. It's Mike's favorite player in the NBA. And I say that very facetiously.
He likes all the dribbling.
I love all the dribbling and all the missed shots during clutch time.
Before we start recording, the last thing that Mike texted me was, James Harden is 1 for 9, a bunch of clown face emojis. So there you go.
Sixers Nets tonight. Oof, man. Harden, I don't know, maybe he's turning around, but man, that guy, if you're hanging your franchise on James Harden, I feel for you. So, yeah, it's interesting. I just feel like the whole thing, it's just like anything. There's unintended consequences, and what has some positive points, there's also clearly some negative points. And I don't know what the right answer is. I don't know how you regulate the transfer portal and make it better. Clearly, NIL, there's no way you could spin it. I don't think that it's a negative for players. It's just, I think players and schools and families have to figure out how to best navigate it. It goes back to your question that you asked me before, too. How do you get kids to stay? Well, man, if you have somebody on your staff, somebody in your athletic department who's on top of NIL, right, and is negotiating those deals and is helping players to navigate that, I mean, at this point, that's probably one of the most valuable people in the whole athletic department if you have somebody who's good at that.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Yeah, one of my buddies, he's the youngest director of football operations in the country, Cole Peterson, but his dad just got hired at Cincinnati. He's a longtime coach, and he's like the associate head coach, but one of his other responsibilities is NIL, and he's just like absolutely like crushing it, going in and talking to all the local businesses and just trying to pump out stuff for Cincinnati football players. So it's like having someone like him, huge in a major program, in my opinion.
Oh, I agree. I think if you have somebody who's good, when you think about how enmeshed and immersed colleges are with the communities where they are, so the University of Cincinnati, within the community of Cincinnati, like those players are well-known, the university is well-known, the number of people that are fans, and then you think about all the different local businesses that would love to tag an athlete onto their commercials or as an endorsement. And it's just, to me, it seems like if you were on top of it and you knew what you were doing as a college, as a program, whether that's football, basketball, whatever, it just seems like the deals would almost write themselves if you're doing your due diligence and doing what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, I saw Timmy, the guy for Gonzaga. He released like a little preview trailer. He's got a Dollar Shave Club commercial for the for the tournament. So that's pretty cool. Like I like
nice.
I'm excited to see. I mean, March Madness could be like the next Super Bowl for commercials, especially with NIL now. Because like seeing all these guys in commercials, I mean, it could be, and women, I don't want to forget about them. That could be pretty cool. But I mean, one thing's gonna be interesting. I'm actually writing an article, putting it together with this other guy, and he's taking more a look at the business of like March Madness and NCAA as a whole, but I'm breaking down the NIL component. And one of the things I'm looking at is, and CBS already sold out all of their ad slots for the rights for the games. But looking at like, what if they would take, and I'm referring to brand, so let's just use, I don't know, Sprite, for example, instead of paying for a $2 million commercial slot, what if they put that $2 million towards social posts, like posts on TikTok, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram with athletes through NIL deals? Like what would have the higher ROI? And I think that's something we could even see a shift in. And I'm sure some of these brands are thinking about that. Because I think, I mean, having your own players promote during the game is, I mean, that's a great deal for brands.
It seems like it would be a no-brainer that if you could get that going, and you think about where we are in terms of the social media side of it, which I know we're going to dive into a little bit more as we move forward here, but players building their own brand and building their content channels on social media. And now you look at the number of people who don't already have the exposure coming in, who aren't athletes, the number of people who have built huge followings wherever, TikTok, Twitter, YouTube, wherever you want to be. And now you talk about these athletes having a built-in platform beforehand, and then you get into the whole March Madness and the exposure that they have. It's just, to me, it seems like it's almost limitless that somebody who is creative in this area could really make a killing. It's just, I mean, it almost seems like it falls right in your lap.
Yeah. For some of the guys, I think that's a true statement. But for some of them, I think it's probably much harder where they actually have to put in the work. Like, I mean, if you're Chet Holmgren, I mean, he's ball his life, overtime, all the media companies do all the work for him, and he gets all the followers. So, like, they kind of, like, boosted his stock. But for some of the lower-end guys, like, I'm thinking of even, like, the Andrew Nahum from Gonzaga, that he probably has to put in a little more work, like, actually building a brand on social media, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, it's...
And those guys could be more local, right? You're talking about the back end starters or guys off the bench. Like, those are the guys that are probably good candidates to hawk for the local car dealership or those kinds of things. Whereas if you're Chet Holmgren, you're talking about you're looking for more national companies with bigger payouts.
Yeah, and even like Boston U, like some of the people in the athletic department, they've been reaching out to me about helping getting BU guys deals, and I'm like, well, listen, like, I'm just going to be honest. Like, none of them have good enough socials for, like, anything national. But you're in Boston. Why don't you go reach out to all the companies in the local area? I'm sure they're already sponsors at the court. They're already sponsors for banquets, et cetera. I'm sure they'd be glad to spend a few hundred, few thousand dollars. What if your guys all get free food for a year? That's just as good of an NIL deal, in my opinion, as getting cash. So,
oh, absolutely.
So, that, I mean, it's really only the 1%, which I think has been a common, I guess the opposing side likes to bring that up, but like, okay, like it's still 1%, which is still better than none. So
exactly. I mean, hey, I would have been very happy to hawk Ponderosa commercials back when I was in college.
Yeah.
I would have been more than happy to do that. So yeah, if they would have fed me for a year, that would have been
Mike,
great.
Mike, do you know how many of our listeners probably don't even remember that Ponderosa existed?
Ponderosa. Yeah,
I mean, yeah. There's no Ponderosas in Ohio anymore.
Ponderosa was a bad steak buffet restaurant, but we would always go there. We'd have practice on Saturday morning, and then we'd go have like an inter-squad scrimmage in the preseason. And then we'd go and sit at Ponderosa for like 4 hours.
You don't know this. Do you not know this? My parents met and worked at Ponderosa. There's a fact for you, Mike.
All right, there you go. All right. So,
lovely mention, Ponderosa.
Doubly connected to Ponderosa. It's all good. I would have loved to eat free for a year.
Is Ponderosa the ones with the real good bread rolls, or am I thinking of somewhere else?
Well,
no, that's Golden Corral. That was Golden Corral back in the day.
Yeah.
Ponderosa had, like, you get the cheap T-bone for like $6.99, then you could get the buffet where they had this was pre players understanding how important nutrition was.
They were the first people to offer free refills. Fun fact about Ponderosa: first people to offer free refills. There you go.
All right. I got a lot of free refills there. Again, probably not the healthiest situation, but nonetheless, we spent a lot of time there just sitting at the buffet and probably eating them out of house and home. They probably weren't happy to have us eat for free.
Hey, college basketball fans, join the action during March Madness with DraftKings Sportsbook. Turn your team's victories into your own big win. New customers can bet $5 on any team to win and get $200 in free bets if they do. It's that simple. If they win, you win. If Sportsbook isn't available in your state yet, you can still join the college hoops action with DraftKings Pools. Everyone can play free pools all March long for a shot at a share of over $250,000 in prizes. Simply join a pool and answer questions like, who will make it to the next round and who will hit the most three-pointers? Then track your results. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code HOOPHEADS, bet $5 on any college hoops team to win, and get $200 in free bets if they do. If they win, you win with promo code HOOPHEADS this week at DraftKings Sportsbook. 21 and over. Restrictions apply. See show notes for details.
All right, so talk to me a little bit about your decision to go to BU.
So I had a crazy recruiting process. I mean, I did a lot of really dumb stuff, which I can kind of laugh about now, but skipping all the offers, etc. It comes down, I go on a visit my senior fall to Army West Point, which is one of the schools that I had an offer from, and they take me to a football game, the whole deal, a normal official visit. It's awesome. I love it. But I get really bought in, and I'm not really paying attention to too much. They take me out to a fun bar, something. Oh, it's Army, but like this is cool, like this is fun. You know, they're telling me all the good things, and then it comes to signing day, and the coach texts me, and he's like, "So what are you guys doing for signing day? We'd love to come down, put on a huge show." And I go, "Coach, to be honest, I've been thinking about it. I don't think I'm going to sign for West Point anymore." and it was the disaster, as I'm sure you can imagine. Just being a dumb 18-year-old kid, I didn't know. And funny enough, I actually Army West Point's in the Patriot League, which was BU. So I played them twice a year I played them 8 times in my career, and the coach never shook my hand, never looked at me. But he's a great guy, besides the fact. And it was just funny to me because coaches do that kind of stuff to players all the time. And when it was flipped, reversed, it was interesting to see how it reacted. But nonetheless, that happened. Went to the state championship my senior year. For some reason, I was never really worried. Like, I knew something was going to happen. Good was going to happen. Someone was going to fall in my lap because I lost all my other offers too. Because, I mean, word gets around. It's a tight community. They thought I was committed there as well. So I play another spring of AAU after my senior season. I go and look at some prep schools up in the Northeast. I decide on one, New Hampton, and it's about a week. So I started earning some offers again because now I'm reclassed. I have another year, and BU was one of them. And then a week before I'm supposed to go to New Hampton, Boston U calls me and goes, "One of our guys left. We had some issues. Do you want to come a year early?" And I go, "Let me come up for a visit." So I go up for a visit. I really like it. I accept. And that was kind of the end of the story. And it worked out pretty well. But it was definitely an unorthodox. You don't hear about too many guys going to, you know, picking their school a year or a week before classes start. And I had a gangbuster first semester, 8 a.m.s and like 7 p.m. classes and all this all over the place because, I mean, they put it together at the last second.
Right.
But it was I learned a lot. And my brother, so my younger brother, he got the, you know, he learned all the, he to avoid all this.
Learned what to not do.
Yeah, right? Which was about everything.
It's kind of amazing. I mean, when you think about just the recruiting process and how, number one, as you said, as an 18-year-old kid, and you just aren't necessarily thinking about the ins and outs and how the process works. And then if your family doesn't necessarily have a lot of experience, and depending upon your AAU coach and your high school coach and who you're getting advice from and where it goes, it's there's more information available now than there ever has been. But I know when I was being recruited, like, I had no idea. My family had no idea. My parents had no idea. So you end up making mistakes and doing things that you're like, "Oh, it should have been pretty obvious that I shouldn't have done that." But you end up just doing some pretty silly things in the course of eventually, hopefully, finding your way to the, you know, to the right place, to a good program, to the place that is going to make sense for you. When you went to school, what was your original thought in terms of what you wanted to study?
Oh, I had no idea. I was like, I just knew. Well, I actually, at first I thought, I was like, I might want to go into medical. I might want to be a doctor. And that quickly evaporated in the first week on campus when my advisors are like, "Yeah, no one's ever done that in the history of basketball. It's not going to work. You have labs, etc." So I was like, "Yeah, you know what? I don't really want to do that either." So I just kind of toyed around for 2 years. And I always kind of knew, like, for me personally, like, I was interested in, like, business topics. Like, real estate isn't what I ended up majoring in. But I was just trying to soak up all the classes that seemed interesting to me. So I did a lot of marketing and all that stuff. But I always knew I wanted to start my own things anyway, or at least be, like, partnered with people that start their own things. So to me, it was just kind of a part of the process. So I was really there to, and I probably shouldn't say this, but I was really there just to hoop and you know, get.
No, let's face it. Most of us who go to school ends up being, or starts out probably being, a secondary. It's like, I have a daughter, and I've told this story a couple times in the pod, but I think it's worth sharing with you. So I have a daughter who's going to be a senior this year, and she's trying to pick a school, and she's a really good student, has never had a B in her entire schooling career. So she kind of has her pick of, she can go pretty much anywhere, but she doesn't have a definitive idea of what she wants to study or really what kind of school she's looking for. And so when she comes to me for advice, I'm like, I don't know what you should look at. I mean, I just picked the school because of basketball. I had the school itself had nothing to do with it. I didn't care about the academic programs. I didn't care about meeting professors. I didn't care about the campus. None of that stuff even remotely factored in for me. It was just, you know, where am I going to go to school so I can play basketball? And for me to be able to give her advice, I'm like, I don't know what you base it on. Like, just look at some pictures on the web. See what place has a nice campus that looks like you might want to go to. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it actually brings up something funny that I just thought about. So, like, I had no idea. Like, Boston U, great school. Like, all these kids. I went to a pretty good public high school where, you know, a lot of guys and girls go to Notre Dame, Ivy Leagues. They go to really good schools. And I always remember I was an okay student. Like, I was just doing my thing. I was pretty smart, but, like, I didn't study. I didn't put a lot of time in. And I remember one day some girl, because when I lost all my offers, like, people knew about it because it was like, this bonehead, what's he doing? This one girl, we'll call her Mary, she just goes, like, oh, you're not going anywhere. You're gonna end up at, like, a trade school. You're not going to do anything. Which, first off, there's nothing wrong with that. But it was just funny that, like, when I ended up signing to Boston University, all the people that put in all the work that, I mean, one of my good friends that played tennis, all he wanted to do was go to, like, a Patriot League or Ivy League. And he did every, you know, he took the ACT, SAT, like, 20 times. Right. And then I ended up there with, like, a 3.0 GPA, 25 ACT, like, not even close to what these people were doing. And I was like, should have played basketball. I mean, what do you want me to tell you? But it was little things like her that, like, stuff like that, that always motivated me. I always tried to use stuff like that as extra motivation. Just kind of funny that it turned out that I ended up going to a really good school.
Yeah, little things like that are definitely things that you remember when people say stuff, whether that's just downing you or making fun of you or whatever. I think those things probably stick with me, and I'm sure stick with you. That'll be with you for the rest of your life. You will always have that conversation that you had with her in the back of your mind without question. And it is true when you look at the ability of somebody to go to a particular school. If you can play football or you can play basketball, you get a lot more leeway when it comes to getting into the better schools. And I think that, look, the athletes who are smart, right? You go there and, yeah, you're focused on playing ball. But once you get there and you get on campus, I think you start to realize that, hey, I got to take advantage of what I have. And I look at it, and if I could go back in time, I probably didn't get as much out of my college academic career as I could have. Not that I didn't get good grades, because I did, but more so of the things that I was learning, I was kind of like, yeah, I got to get through and get my A, get my B, whatever it is, but not necessarily diving in and taking it to heart. I think if I went back and took my college curriculum today, I'd get way more out of the classes sitting there as an old guy, as opposed to what I got out of them when I was 18 or 19 years old, where I was just kind of trying to get through my day to get to practice.
Yeah. I mean, people don't understand that grind either. Like, I hated it at times when you're involved in it, but I think it has a really long lasting effect for the rest of your life. Cause even sometimes now when I have to wake up early or do something and I'm like, I'd rather do this than what I used to go through. So there's that aspect as well. But, I mean, at least for me, for school, I was always just thinking more about, like, connections and networking, going, okay, like, who can I now say, oh, I was a Division I basketball player and I went to Boston University. Like, who fits in those two categories? And
right,
it's crazy how far that will take you, and it already has. And so then back to your point even about, like, helping getting in school, I mean, if you're, and I tell this to my cousins, like my younger cousins, like if you're trying to go to a really good school, just play a sport. You don't even have to be that good, and just talk to the coaches about walking on, and they can help you get admitted with lower grades and stuff. Like at least go that route. And then you can, if you don't want to end up playing the sport, you can literally quit 2 weeks in. Like people, I see people do that all the time, especially at BU. I saw a lot of people do that with like rowing and sports like that.
That's
and
what I was just going to say.
And I'm like, you're so smart. Cause like they go around campus like recruiting people. And I'm like, man, those people are paying $80,000 a year to wake up at 4 a.m. and just row a boat. I'm like, that sucks. But like there was like 30 girls at the start of the year that they're freshmen and they got into school saying they were going to row and then they just quit because it helped them get in. I was like, no, they're the real smart ones.
That's a good strategy. We had somebody tell us that what you should do is look at schools, look at their majors, and then find like a really obscure major. Like say, I'm really passionate about Korean studies and I need to this is the program that I've always dreamed of. And then get on campus, get registered for your Korean studies classes. And then 2 weeks in, it's not quite what I thought. I think I'm going to drop those classes and maybe get into the business school. So somebody else, it's funny.
Yeah, or maybe just do what all those people at USC did. Just pay the professors right. And the coaches. Just don't get caught and you'll be good.
Exactly. Yeah, it's, I don't know, with as expensive as college is today, let's put it this way, being able to get some money for athletics is certainly something that is, if you can do it, it definitely helps. And now with the NIL piece of it, if you get an opportunity to, even you put a few bucks in your pocket, or like you said, you get an opportunity to eat free or whatever it might be. I just think it opens up a whole other world of possibilities. I know one of the things that you wrote an article about was, and it came to mind as you were talking about the grind of Division I college basketball. And I often think about my experience and just how there were days, especially when I was a freshman, I didn't play very much. And my last 3 years, I played a lot. It was a little easier, but my freshman year was really, really tough to kind of grind through and make it to practice. And you wrote an article about the difference between a coach that is a tough coach and a coach that it's just somebody who doesn't do a good job, but is, they can have similar qualities, but just maybe talk a little bit about in your mind, what makes somebody a tough coach versus somebody who's just a pain in the neck.
Yeah, I think the tough coaches, like first off, they always have your back and like they got you no matter what. The way they do things is like they might get mad at you. And this is like you see this in families as well. Like you're able to get mad at each other or fight. Like I always see that's how you know people are good friends is like they can get mad at each other and like joke around and kind of, you know, fight a little, because that's like what me and my brothers always did. So like I know my really good friends, like that's how we are as well. So it's like that kind of family relationship with a coach almost where they're going to get really mad or et cetera, but it's because they want the best for you. And then on the flip, you know, after practice, the next day, whatever, you know, they're going to be like, hey, you understand why I got mad. Like it's all cool and it's good. But I think the ones that don't do that well is they'll do that same thing, but then like they'll ignore you. Or they won't talk to you for several days, or you know they just do little petty things, and it's like, why are you doing that? Like what purpose are you serving? Like without the player, like coaches need the players, you know, players kind of need the coaching for sure, but it's like that. There was always just like little things like that I saw in other coaches as well, and I always tried to pick up like what do good coaches do. And it's like they get on guys, but then they like reconcile. And usually they don't even have to say anything because it's just like eventually they just know. Like it's just a shared bond.
Yeah, that relationship piece, right? It's so important. I think so much of what you see sometimes, I think, in bad coaches is exactly what you said. Like they want to get on a player. They want to get after a player. And it becomes this – it's almost – a psychological warfare where then, okay, then I'm not going to talk to you. Then I'm going to stomp around and be mad, as opposed to, look, in the moment, I'm trying to get the most out of you. So I might yell, I might get angry, I might push you harder than you want to be pushed. But 20 minutes after practice, we could sit down and watch film together and work on trying to get you better. And I think that's the difference, is you got to invest in the players. The players have to know that you have their back and that you care about them and that ultimately you want what's best for them. And that's why you're pushing hard. And I think a coach who doesn't communicate that, and you can define communication obviously in a lot of different ways, but a coach who doesn't communicate that, that's where you run the risk of, it's the grind of college basketball, especially at the Division I level, and especially today. Like, I think about what you went through in your career just in terms of the summer stuff, and maybe we should talk about that a little bit too, but it was completely different back when I played, where I got done with my season, they handed me like a 2-page worksheet. They're like, all right, we'll see you back here in August. And that was it. And obviously now guys are on campus 50 weeks out of the year in a lot of cases. And so I think that makes it even more important that that player coach relationship, there better be a bond between the two. Cause man, if you had somebody that you didn't like, or that didn't like you, or that didn't invest in you to spend that much time with them, oof, man, that'd be rough.
Yeah, and you see that. I mean, that's tough always. It's tough for both sides. But, yeah, I mean, summer, I don't know how you want to get into that, if you want to.
Yeah, to just tell me a little bit about, like, so what's it – because I feel like – and I know, like, times were different. So, like, when I got done playing, when our season ended, I just wanted to go play some pickup basketball and just play and just be able to have some fun and then get away from it and then kind of work on my game. Just me going back to kind of my high school days where I'm just trying to get better and I'm in the gym working on my game. And I didn't necessarily want to listen to the same coaches that were chirping at me all year, chirp at me all summer. So just what was that like for you and how did you handle it? What were your thoughts about it? And obviously you didn't grow up and live in the system that I lived in. So you can only kind of go through your own experience. But just talk to me a little bit about what that was like, maybe how the coaches tried to handle that, to deal with it. Because we've had some college coaches that have said, you never want to have less access to your players. But in a lot of ways, I think coaches sometimes think it's too much too.
Oh, yeah. For me, it was too much. I think it was actually, it hurt more than it helped. Because first off, you went through a whole season. And like you said, you just wanted to play pickup basketball. Well, college basketball is very, very structured. And, like, I love basketball, but I started to lose, like, I guess maybe burnout's the right word. But, like, because it was so structured and you can never really just go play. It was always, like, this workout, play this way. When it's, like, you grew up just playing free your whole life and it became way too structured and felt like a job. And when you throw that in the summer, it's, like, it kind of, like, backfires. And for example, Colgate, they won the Patriot League title last night and they were in our conference. My junior year, we beat them in the championship, and then COVID happened, which sucked. But literally the one year there's not an NCAA tournament.
Yeah, that's your year, right?
I don't get to go. Yeah, but don't get me started on that. I'll get all fired up. But they never had guys in the summer, and they've been in the championship the last 5 years. So, like, you can't tell me that having guys on the summer versus not, like, makes too much of a difference. All they did is they had a camp. They hosted camps, like kids camps, elite camps, for 2 weeks in the summer. And all the guys, not all of them, most of them would come back and they would just work the camp so they'd make money. And then they'd play pickup, hang out with the guys. And that was it for the whole summer. Meanwhile, we had two summer sessions that were 6 weeks long or 5 weeks long, something like that. And we have to take a class, which it was nice to take a class because then you get a harder one out of the way in the summer instead of the fall or the spring. But then you have individual workouts. Then you have lifting, and the lifting is much harder in the summer than it is in the fall or the spring. And you also have like team workouts. But the cool thing is that did lead us to go to Spain as well. So we got to go on a Spain trip, which was an awesome 10 days. But all in all, like, the summer to me was kind of a waste. It was some of the best times in terms of just hanging out with the guys. You have a lot of free time. It's really nice in the Northeast. Like, Boston's great for 3 months of the year and just hanging out and going out and not too many responsibilities. But in terms of basketball, to me, it didn't do much. I got better from the 3 or 4 weeks I was at home during the year than I did the 9 to 10 weeks in the summer I was at school.
How did your staff handle it? What was their approach to it? Obviously, they're not having a conversation with you like, oh, we don't want to be doing this. But just what does it look like in terms of how they handled it and structured it? And what was the attitude like and their approach to it compared to their approach, let's say, during the season?
I mean, it was a little more laid back, but a lot of it was setting the groundwork, right? Because you bring their whole approach, which I get this, is let's bring the freshmen in. And they make the freshmen go to both summer sessions where, like, anyone else, they let you only pick one. So you have to go to one, but there's only one mandatory. So, like, the first summer session is mostly just workouts and, like, one-on-ones. So, like, I get that. Bring the freshmen in, break them in, have them play, get used to the college speed, the campus, etc., a little more. But you have to remember, like, especially during July, there's AAU. So they're literally on campus like 2 or 3 days of the week, and then they're traveling. So it's like you're on your own a lot anyway, and you're kind of forced to a schedule. So like for me, I liked being at home and having like my lifting routine because I liked what I did. But then you go to school, it's like you don't have any say in that. Like you're going to do like what they tell you to do. And like what they told me to do, you know, might have been good for 2 or 3 other people, but for my body type, I needed something a little different. And so like when if I was at home, I would have been able to get myself more ready in that sense. But I mean, the coaches were good about it. I get their points, but overall, I would say it makes more sense to go for maybe 2 or 3 weeks in the summer, or maybe two-week sessions instead of just, you know, 5 to 10 weeks like we have.
Yeah, it just seems like it's way too much. I just don't see how when it's that demanding during the season and as a coaching staff, you pour so much into it and then to spend all that time. It just feels like as a coach, Jason and I are both teachers now, and the idea of having your students all year long, and then like my school, we offer summer school, and there's some teachers on the staff that then they go and teach summer school. And I mean, I can't run away from that fast enough as a teacher. I'm like, I need a break. And I would think as coaches, it's just to keep grinding away all that time. It just feels like everybody, like you said, would benefit from the opportunity to get away. And I get why more access. Coaches are never going to say, oh, we want less access to our players. But in a lot of cases, it's too much. So here in the state of Ohio, once COVID hit, Ohio used to have a rule that in June, you were allowed to coach. You had 10 days as a high school coach. You could have 10 days with your team of coaching. So you could take them to team camp. You could practice for 8 hours a day. You could do whatever you wanted. So you had these 10 contact days. And otherwise, you could only have open gym. So you could open up the gym and guys could play, but you couldn't coach. And then as a result of COVID, because the seasons got shut down and a lot of teams didn't play a lot of games, not this past most recent season, but season before, they basically, Ohio just said, you can now have unlimited contact as much as you want in June and July. So now, as a high school coach, you could theoretically have your guys every single day of the summer. And there are some coaches who've done that. And then there are other coaches who obviously have not done 7 days a week. But it's just, it feels like it's too much. Like there's a happy medium there. Like, yeah, you might want more than 10 days, but when you start getting into every day, and then if you're a coach and you don't do every day and the guy in the next city over or the next school is doing that, then people are looking at you going, why aren't you doing that? And you're like, because I'm a high school coach and I've got a family and I've got the kids need to get away from me and I need to get away from them a little. I think it's a case of how much is too much.
Yeah. Well, the problem is more so like the burnout and then the injuries. Like you'd see a lot of guys get hurt in October or September for us, which is like to me, because the whole summer you're grinding, then you go home for like 2 weeks right before school starts, you come back, you ease in, then you go like full speed. And it's like your body was just been through too much, too many ups and downs. And, that's when we'd have a lot of guys go down. I mean, I got hurt, I think, twice in that time period as well. And it's not like they're like overuse injuries for most of the guys.
And then you think about the way that guys are playing you talked about it earlier, playing AAU from the time you're in fourth grade, right? So you're basically playing all winter long, and then you're playing again all these games on the AAU circuit, and kids aren't playing as many different sports as they used to. And so if you want to be good at any kind of skill-specific sport, you got to start putting in time. When you're younger, it becomes more and more of a challenge to get people to understand that you can still be a multi-sport athlete when you're young and still have success as you get older. There's not that many people that are subscribing to that theory anymore, even though I think it's one that has a lot of merit, that you could wait longer to start specializing than what kids typically do today, just because I think parents look around, they see, oh, my neighbor's kid is playing in this, and he can't play summer baseball because he's got to be playing 50 AAU games this summer. And once you get to high school and you get to a point where, yeah, it's time to probably pick a sport, it's really difficult unless you're an incredible athlete or you're at a really small school. I think it's hard to play three sports, and it's certainly hard to be the star. You don't see many three-sport star athletes anymore. You might see somebody who plays three sports still, but they're probably not the best player in any one of those sports just because of the amount of time it takes and how skilled people are today. So it's just a different way of kind of approaching it. I think those overuse injuries are certainly something that are a factor. I know that I've read some stuff about NBA teams being really worried about guys like Zion, who's been out for ages, that how much of the amount of time that you spend running up and down a court.
Oh, okay, Mike, we got to include him in our guest.
Yes,
we got to include him in the guest.
I'm stepping back.
Andrew, okay, so I want your honest opinion.
All right, I'm ready.
I have placed the over-under at 250 games of Zion's NBA career. Will he play more or less than 250 games?
How many has he played so far?
84, I think, right, Mike? Is that right?
85.
So, like, basically triple that. Wow, that's a good DraftKings should include that.
They should.
Promotion. Right?
That's good. DraftKings is jumping on, so we'll have a DraftKings promotion as part of the episode. But make sure you jump on here during conference championship week and get your bets in for DraftKings for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I would say he's gonna play under that.
Oh, like there we go. Someone else joins my bandwagon.
He seems like another Greg Oden type.
Mike, I told you.
Look, it's entirely possible. I'm choosing to be optimistic, but the realist in me says that maybe you guys are right. I don't know. The body type that he has and just where it looks like he is right now in the moment, it doesn't seem like he's going to come back this year. So you got another lost season. You cross your fingers and hope that it's a Joel Embiid situation, that he struggles out of the gate and eventually gets his body right. He's able to get back on the floor and play, but who knows?
It's all going to be who's in his circle. I don't know who's in his circle, but if he has the right people, he'll be fine. If he doesn't, then he'll probably struggle and, could have been, should have been type of deal.
Yeah. So
listen,
true.
If he had the right people in his circle, he wouldn't be eating at the buffet all the time. Hi, Andrew. I'm just telling you. I'm sorry. That probably seems rude, but it's been the running theme that we've talked about. He just needs to get a nutritionist. That's what he really needs. He needs a nutritionist to make
sure. At a certain point, right? You just have to. You either start to take your career more seriously and try to figure out, hey, what does it take in order for me to be able to play, or you don't, and eventually. Look, your talent takes you a long way, but eventually your talent starts to diminish, starts to run out. And if you can't stay healthy, your career's going to be over faster than certainly anybody would have believed was possible when you first got drafted, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see.
Yep.
We shall see.
He's such a unique player that, I mean, I hope he gets back. That's why I try to take the optimist side of things, but who knows? You mentioned just a second ago about players with like Zion having the right network around them. You talked about it earlier for yourself, just as a college athlete and a college student athlete, try to look around and say, okay, who can I connect with when I start thinking about what I'm going to do once I graduate from college? So talk a little bit about that process and how it sort of led you into what you're doing now and kind of the direction that your career is taking to get started.
For sure. Yeah. So, I mean, personally myself, I always knew, like, I kind of wanted to do somewhat of my own thing. I liked building things. I know I get bored with stuff pretty easily. So to me, it was like, I'm going to have a hard time kind of like sitting at an office or going and doing like a finance job, which is what a lot of not only my teammates, but people at BU end up doing. So it was all about kind of finding the people that they have at least, they kind of maybe do their own thing or they're involved in groups of other people that do stuff like that. And to me, like, the first place was real estate, but not a great time with COVID to get into that at all. And the only opportunities I had were more corporate stuff. And I was like, I'm not going to sit on an Excel sheet for 9 hours a day, whatever. So I'm not doing that. And I started the newsletter, started putting stuff out. And through that, and social media is awesome in that lane, I've met a ton of really cool people. And then AIR kind of came into the loop. I met up with James, who founded it, and it was still very, very early on, like only 2 months in he had started. And I kind of have a product mind and can understand how things should be built like digitally. And so we've been doing that for a year. And then I've been trying to grow my newsletter as well and my Twitter. And I mean, my main goal is, like, I've always been fascinated with people, not just in sports, but, you know, entertainment, business, et cetera, that are like true peak performers, where, like, to be a peak performer, you got to be on top of your game on everything. And, like, to me, that's the definition of many athletes, where, like, physically they're at peak form, financially they're usually at peak form. So that's where a lot of it's come in, at least on my Twitter and newsletter, where it's like the business of athletes. Because to me, if you're the top of the top athlete wise, you're probably taken care of financially, and you had to have had it mentally. So that kind of encircles the whole thing. And then those people usually had good circles of people around them. And that's kind of what I've been fascinated with. And, you know, one day I want to start getting some professional athletes on and talk to them about, like, their journeys as well. But I don't know, I'm just kind of building, trying to stay in the space of the athlete and business side, because sports and that is what interests me the most, and that I wake up and do all, not all day, every day, but that I don't get bored with is the main key.
What's your writing process? How'd you develop your writing skill?
Well, funny enough, I never, you would have told me I write at all, I would have been like, what? In college, I've been, that's stupid. I got C's on all my papers. You know, high school, college, I don't want to write any papers. But actually my senior year, so I read this book called The Compound Effect, which is a fantastic book. And it just basically says, like, break things down. Like, everyone wants to do everything at once. And it's like, one of the examples was, like, even for school, like, if you have a paper and it worked out, I was reading the book at the same time that I was writing this paper. And I was like, if you have a 7-page paper, break it into, you know, write a paragraph every day. You'll see you have a little extra motivation. Write two. And instead of trying to write all 7 pages at once, which is what I probably normally would have done, I wrote like 1 page a day. And it was the best thing ever. And I've applied it to basically every area of my life. And it's just so much better in general. But then I was like, oh, I did really good on that paper. My professor's like, yo, you got really good, you know, talent with that. And then I was like, well, what do I like that I could start writing about? And I started people putting stuff out on Twitter. And I was like, heck, let's do it. I'll kind of put shorter form on Twitter, push them to the newsletter. And I actually went back the other day and started reading some of my first articles. And I was like, man, that sucked. I had no clue what I was writing. I had no style. But it started getting...
It's like us on our first few podcasts, Andrew.
Oh, yeah. I bet.
That sounds completely familiar, man. Those things.
Once you said that, I was like, oh, my gosh.
Oh, they're brutal.
God, if we go back and let's do our first set of podcasts, Andrew, I'm saying like and like 5 million times in an episode. It was terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Yeah. I mean, that's how it is with everything. That's why they say just jump in, do it, take action. Sometimes I think what annoys people is you have to go with stuff like this, like a podcast or a newsletter. You have to go, you'll go forward, but at times you'll go backwards a little before you go forward again. And usually on those first initial backwards, like once the motivation runs out, people kind of quit. And like to me, I understood that. And so I've always just been like, hey, this little down is where I'm going to, you know, boost it up and get better. So, you know, now I have the whole structure, and I have basically a curation form of where all my content comes into through Google Alerts, Twitter, etc. And so now every morning I take like 20, 30 minutes and I go through all of them and I go, okay, here were say five interesting things. Maybe I'll touch on this one for an article or whatever. But I mean, the process, like, it was such a mess at first, and now it's like so refined and perfect. I'm always trying to find more ways to automate it and make it better, as I'm sure you guys have done the same with this. But it's really cool to see that progress more than the growth or the followers or anything else.
Yeah. Getting your processes down definitely makes things easier. I know that Jason and I, when we first started, and we would kind of share the duties of editing episodes and putting them together and stitching them and trying to learn just the software to make it work. And when we first started, we had no idea we were going to interview anybody. I mean, we knew at some point we were going to do some interviews, but we started out with the idea that it was going to be a youth basketball parenting podcast. And Jason and I would just go on and we'd talk back and forth, and we had one microphone and we'd both be sitting there talking into the same mic. And we're like, how would we ever record with somebody else? And the first couple of interviews we did, I drove to the places, local high school coaches, and sat down in their coach's office with them and had one mic for me and one mic for them. And we're kind of talking, and eventually you learn and you figure it out. And you're like, okay, how do we use the editing software? And like the first couple episodes that we did with people and doing the interviews, and you go back and there's so much background noise and there's this and that. We did one episode where we're like, is the guy we're interviewing, is he inside like a big giant oil tank? Like what is going on? And eventually you just kind of figure it out. Not that what we do now is perfect, but it's certainly the amount of time that we spent to get an inferior product at the beginning compared to the amount of time it takes now to put out a much more superior sounding podcast. It doesn't even compare, and I'm sure you're feeling the same way.
For sure. Yeah, no, I mean, and I don't know if you have this backlash at all, but like, especially on Twitter, with something else, I think that you can see like where, and I used to give athletes crap for this, at least when I was in college, of like, oh, complaining about mental health, etc. But like, I've been putting out stuff on Twitter, and I've been doing like today I did a thread on Kyrie Irving's best investments, and it's got like 1 million impressions. It has like 1,000 retweets right now, like 9,000 likes. But like, I read through some of the comments and I'm like, man, people are ruthless, man. I'm like, I'm like, you literally took time out of your day to like come at my life for no reason. Like, I'm just putting this out there. But that
tells you that you've made it though. If you're getting the trolls, that means you've made it.
Oh, I know, but it's just funny. Like, you can see how people get caught up in those, and like, people might put out good one and stop. But like, that's the stuff I'm like, I always think like, man, you have no life if you're like commenting on this something negative. And then meanwhile, I have like professional athletes that are like, Mario Goitze scored the game winning goal in FIFA. He like follows me. So I'm like, okay, like I'm should be more happy about that than like some dude telling me that like this thread is stupid or you don't know what you're talking about. It's just people are funny. I'm sure you guys get some of that as well, or maybe not as much publicly, but privately, you know, people always saying stuff like, oh, you're a writer now. And I'm like, yeah, I am. What do you do? Like,
yeah, I think it's endemic to the situation, right? If you're putting something out there and it's out there for the public to consume, there's always going to be people that have different kinds of opinions on it. I think, like Jason said, ultimately you want to be in that position where if you're putting out good things, kind of like being a coach, right? Like, if you're a good coach, right, not every person is going to love you, because you can't play everybody. Not every parent is going to be happy with their kid's high school coach, because some kids aren't going to play. You're going to have to make tough decisions. If you're trying to make every single person happy, then you're not going to make anybody happy as a coach, as a writer, as a podcaster. Like, look, our podcast is good for some people, and there's other people that probably listen to it and they're like, ugh, I would never listen to another episode ever again. It's the same way with a writer. If you're going to have opinions and you're going to share things, some people are going to be like, yeah, that's content that I'm looking for, and other people.
And there's probably some, Mike, that come to our podcast every Tuesday when we record the NBA, and they skip right to the dad jokes because they know how great they are at the end.
There you go. That's it. Or maybe there's people, I'm sure there are a lot of people that our coaches that listen to the coaching interview episodes and the stuff that we do on the NBA, they probably don't even listen to that. And it's just, you know, you just try to find what works for you, and you got to do what you like to do, what you enjoy doing, and then hope that you can find an audience for that, or tailor what you do. Try to bend it so that you can do what you enjoy and do it for an audience that finds value in it. That's really what it's all about.
Just spray on the wall, see what sticks, yeah. Go with it. And then
absolutely.
You know, expect nothing. Like for me, like what's always been good is I expect nothing, right? I put out something and I go, this is going to suck. No one's going to like it. And that's good. And then when, if it does well, I'm like, oh, that's cool. I'm glad. And if it doesn't, you're like, well, yeah. And I think college recruiting sports has always been a good, I think a lot of people, you know, they get something in their life and they get their hopes real high up on something like, oh yes, yes, yes. Like finally going to happen. And I was always that way. Oh, this coach finally reached out to me. I'm going to get this offer. And then your hopes get shattered and it like puts you in a bad place. So like I've taken that same concept, and this is why like sports, basketball, it's just so important to life. I don't know how you could have kids and not have them play sports at least for a few years, but like those like getting your hopes up, et cetera, that's always, you know, not doing that for me has been huge, because you just stay level, good, bad. You just try to stay level where most people swing heavy up and down.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think you have to maintain optimism and yet at the same time be able to understand. You said it best when you talked about that dip that a lot of us go through, right? When you're starting out something new, there's that initial excitement. And then maybe it doesn't grow or doesn't get as big as you hoped it would. And then that's where most people give up, because they haven't kind of fought through. And I think athletics teaches you that. And it makes you understand that, look, I got to put a lot of work in to be good at something. And just because I go out and practice today for an hour doesn't mean that I'm suddenly going to be the best player on the floor tomorrow. That's a long process. And if you think it's going to happen overnight, you're wrong. You got to keep trying to put your best work out there. You got to keep working at the game and improving, getting better. And if you do, then I think no matter what it is that you're doing, you're going to at least be satisfied with what you're doing. You're going to be proud of what you're putting out there. And I think really that's ultimately what all of us are trying to do, whether it's trying to put our best selves out there as a player, as a coach, as an entrepreneur, as a podcaster, as a writer. You're trying to do the best work that you possibly can do and just see where the results lie, right?
Yeah, and there's also 7 billion people or whatever on this planet. Like, everyone thinks it all revolves around them. And like, oh, everyone needs to listen to me. Everyone needs to read my stuff, listen to my stuff. It's like, and I'll do it perspective for me. I write about mostly the business of sports and athletes. A lot of people, they're in Ukraine fleeing for their life, you know, prayers up to them. Yeah. But it's like, you think they care about what I'm doing? No. So like having some perspective on that. Yeah. As well, is important.
That's so true. All right, let me ask you a couple questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
From an athlete perspective, if I'm an athlete and I want to set myself up so that I can make some money through NIL, let's say I'm a high school senior, regardless of sport, but let's focus on basketball. If I'm a basketball player who next year I'm going to be a senior in high school, and I want to start to be able to kind of set myself up to have an opportunity to make some money NIL-wise. And again, you can take this to whatever level the kid's going to play at. But just in general, what are some things that players can do to sort of set themselves up well to be able to make some money on NIL?
Well, first off, if you're a stud, that really helps. But I'll take it more from like my perspective of being like a mid-major good player. Because if you fit into this category, you can obviously be higher and still do really well. Or you should, without excuses, honestly. But first, you got to like set up your social medias, and posting like sport content's great. But you have to show like some bit of yourself outside of that. I've seen that work great. And people have stories. So there's this guy, John Seaton. And at Air, we actually signed him to a few NIL deals. And he puts out like, he's an offensive lineman. And he puts out content about just like being a big guy and like funny, you know, relatable stuff. And it's like, man, people love that. He's like 2 million followers. Like, and it's like a little bit football. Most of it's just relatable to life and offensive linemen. And then also like bigger guys. And that's like kind of what I think he's called, like the Big Guy, or you have some brand on it. But it's like finding little things like that. And if you're interested in shoes, you know, show that, whatever. But have some at least differentiation of like your interest outside of your sport, because those will be a lot of the brands that end up reaching out to you and wanting to do deals, because you'll be kind of like that sports person in that niche. And then beyond that, I mean, a lot of it, I think, comes to education. I know there's a bunch of companies trying to sell courses and all kinds of stuff now around NIL education. I think a lot of it's pretty straightforward. Like, just learn in YouTube, like use it to your benefit. Basic, you know, finances, budgeting, and the people in your circle is going to be important as well, of having people that can at least help you navigate a little. I think we're going to see problems maybe next year, but probably over the next few, where we see kids like signing deals that don't end up working out, and there's lawsuits, whether from the brand or the athlete, just because there's a lot of fine print. But yeah, like trying to do some research on your own and just be like, hey, NIL, whatever it is, type it in YouTube, how taxes work in NIL, how brands sign deals, how to read a contract, whatever, like pick up little things, and that becomes from self-educating. And I try to put out some of that content. I'm currently working on a deal with this company that's trying to have me put out like a 5-part series for athletes, and they want it, you know, the end of the thesis to go back to their brand of like why they should use them, which I'm cool with actually. But it's more like the key points of like, hey, here's how to set up an LLC, etc. So going through all those things. But at the core basics of it, if you can build a social media and you can, I mean, going from like a three star player to a 4-star player would do a lot more for your NIL worth than going from 3,000 to 4,000 followers on Twitter or Instagram would. So,
yeah.
I mean, a lot of it, you know, it's just living your life, and the NIL will kind of fall. If you're really going to try to force it, then you might miss out on the actual sport itself.
Talk a little bit about why you think athletes running camps is such a good idea.
That is a great idea. So I don't know why that wasn't allowed to begin with. I know they do things like under the coaches and stuff, but like from a local perspective, if you're a Division I athlete, or really any athlete that goes to play in college, like kids are going to look up to you. I mean, I even had that in where I grew up a lot. And it's like, if I had a camp, and so one of the guys that I played with, he's the starting quarterback at Boston College now, Phil Dracovic, and I'm like, bro, you got to run a camp next summer. And so he's currently, I'm trying to help him a little and work on that. But it's like, you get a couple hundred kids, I mean, you can get someone to sponsor it too, get t-shirts. Now this builds up your personal brand from like a fan / loyalty perspective, along with the cash you're going to get, but you're making a real impact in the community. And I think I think a lot of people that were against NIL, it's hard for them to like still be against it when you see some of what these kids are doing, when they're donating part of their NIL deals to charity, they're going to the children's hospital, they're raising money, they're running camps to help kids, etc. It's like these college kids, a lot of them are good at heart. Like I you got to love to see that kind of stuff.
The camp piece of it, and I've been running youth basketball camps. I started mine not my first year out of college, but my second year out of college. And I've been doing it ever since. So I think this is maybe 30th summer coming up. But it's just something – 31? All right, 31. Something – sounds – hey, whatever, man. Let's put it this way. It's been a long time. And I think that when – obviously now my playing days are long since gone, and there's nobody who has kids who are – my camps are mostly for elementary school age kids – so there's nobody who has kids that are that age that remember me as a player that don't have the name recognition that I did when I was 23. It was completely different, right? At that point, there were lots of people in the community that still knew me, remembered me from when I played at the local high school or when I played in college. And so my name carried a little bit more value. You think about a kid today, you go back to your hometown and you run a basketball camp at your high school that you went. I mean, I just don't see how there's any way that with even the most minimum of effort that you could get 50, 75 kids and in whatever, run a 3-day camp, run a 5-day camp, whatever you want to do. And you could easily make a couple thousand bucks. And if you have a bigger name or you have a bigger community, you can easily do a lot more than that. And I don't think it takes a ton of work or a ton. It doesn't take a lot of specialized knowledge, right? You're just doing your thing. You're just doing what you've done, and you're trying to give back to the community and kids. Look, if you have 7, 8, 9 year old kids, they, as you said, look up to those local athletes. And it's just, I always try to have, as part of my camp, I always try to have a balance between, now I used to be one of the young guys, but now I'm one of the old guys on the coaching staff. But you try to have a few old guys to kind of keep things running smoothly. But then you got to have some high school and college kids that those younger kids can look up to, and they bring a little bit more energy and a little bit different vibe to the camp. And I just think, from an NIL standpoint, that's something, like we talked about earlier, that if you have somebody who's good as part of your athletic department or on your staff as a program, like helping a kid set up a camp in their hometown, to me, every staff in the country should be trying to help their players to do that.
Yeah, I think camps aren't too difficult at all. I mean, that's why Nike, I'm not sure if you saw this, but Nike's like paying a bunch of Ohio State players to run camps. Like, that's genius, because Nike's obviously the one. They don't have to put any time and hire people now. They just easily probably do it for cheaper instead of hiring coaches. Go get players. So it's like, if you're a player, you should see like, oh, there's probably a reason they're hiring 17 of us. They're probably doing pretty well on it. Maybe we should just – 17 of us should just run our own and hire someone that's good at setting up camps. Maybe even like your recruit or your like director of football operations would probably do it for free even for you.
Right.
And you would make a lot more, which isn't even the point. You would run a better camp too, because now people will be like, oh, I know it's not Nike just trying to come in.
Right, for sure. You're cutting out the middleman.
Exactly.
That makes a ton of sense. What about NFTs? I know you've written a couple of things about NFTs, and that's one of those things that when I look at it, my son right now, he's a sophomore in high school, and so he did some crypto investing, and he's trying to get me to set up accounts for him, and he wants to buy NFTs, and that's the whole reason why I got into crypto, and he's trying to explain it to me, and I think I understand the basic idea behind it, but I'm not sure that I understand how the value is created. So just talk to us a little bit about NFTs and what you know about them and where you think and how you think they're going to fit into the sports landscape moving forward.
Yeah, well, personally, I think, and I'm learning just like everyone else. I mean, there's a lot to them, not being technical on all this, but I think they're going to be big in sports, not only from the standpoint of like athletes actually using them, but also stadiums, teams, like fan tokens, etc. I think something that in these sports teams, you see it in the MLB, they're always looking for more ways to make money, right? Oh, they don't want to pay the players more money, but they want more playoff games. Why? Because more playoff games equals more revenue for the league. Okay, makes sense, right? But we're forgetting that like the athletes are the ones that drive all this. So it's basically saying like the athletes, from an endorsement perspective, the fans really, a lot of the times, like for me watching NBA, Pittsburgh doesn't have a team, right? So who do I root for? I don't root for Cleveland. I don't root for Philly. I root for players. I don't root for teams. I root for players in the NBA. So it's like, since I'm not invested in buying jerseys or going to games for an NBA team in Pittsburgh, maybe I buy an NFT of, let's say, Steph Curry. And this NFT, it comes and you have it on a digital wallet, whatever, cool. But that's not really the main point. It's the utility that comes behind it. And the utility, and this is what's going to be important, but we've had a lot of issues, like De'Aaron Fox like tried to do this and then he ditched out of it, and his investors or all his fans really lost like $2 million collectively because he just decided not to do it anymore. But you would get like signed jerseys, you get access to him, you get to talk to him. So it's like creating more of a fan engagement, and that's how teams are going to use it as well, through like tokens and et cetera, because now it's not just your local community that's cheering on the team. It's the world. There's people from around the world that love, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers. Well, it's like, well, if the Steelers release an NFT, that's more revenue, and maybe it's an additional ways to get fans engaged. And then from the standpoint of ticketing, where I think it's going to be the first place it goes, is it doesn't technically remove scalpers, but say the Steelers want to sell tickets, right, and they sell them for $100. Well, a scalper goes and sells them for $120. Well, the team didn't make any money on that $120 that was now sold. The scalper made the $20. Well, with NFTs, because it's all back to the blockchain and traceable, the team gets percentages for every secondary market sale. So the team not only makes $100 from the first sale, but then once it sells for $120 on the secondary market from a scalper, they maybe get 5 to 10%. So it's like you get, you know, teams are going to see that as like, hey, scalping's always been a problem. This easily fixes that. So I think that's going to be the first place it goes.
How soon do you think that comes online?
Next couple of years. I know there's a few teams that are already kind of dabbling in it a little. They're like moving tickets all to phones. I think that's like the start of it. And then they'll start to do it all through NFTs once the blockchain and these ecosystems are more set up, because it's still very early on. And I think the way I look at it is like you had Google. Like Google was a search engine, right? So all these companies that are worth now millions, billions of dollars, they've done good because of Google, because people have been able to find out about them on Google. Well, to me, like the next kind of version of that is like Bitcoin, Ethereum, etc., because they're on the blockchain, which is separate. So like they're building off of Ethereum, just like other companies build off of Google. So it's still early on. We'll see how it goes. There's a ton of censorship, you know, privacy, all that kind of stuff. But used the right way, it's very effective and good for like freedom and us as people, and especially athletes who can monetize further. They can monetize their fan base beyond just, you know, their salary and endorsements from companies. They can actually get paid from the fans for whatever.
I think the idea of being able to continuously cash in on the secondary market, I think that's an area where we're definitely going to see this come into play. I just listened to, Jason, I don't know if you listened to the episode, it was sometime in the last week, Bill Simmons with the owner of one of the minority owners of the Philadelphia 76ers, who is one of the, I think he's one of the owners of Fanatics. And they were just talking about the sports card business and sort of the same thing, Andrew, that you were talking about, where so Topps puts out a card and they initially sell that card for whatever, but then that card gets sold multiple times over and over and over again, and Topps and the athlete never get any piece of that particular revenue. And he was just talking about how eventually what they're trying to get to is where, same thing that you have with the NFT market, where the card market, once it's sold on the secondary market, then the team or the player or the company, whatever, ends up getting a percentage of that secondary market sale, which when you think about the ability to capture that revenue and bring it back to the original source of the creation of the sports card or the NFT or whatever it is, that's something that certainly there's a lot of money sitting there to be made for somebody who can figure out how to do that in the right way so that it works for both ends of that equation, both ends of that transaction.
No doubt. Yeah. I mean, the secondary will be, and teams are always looking for more revenue. So it's the no brainer, right? Like, hey, let's get secondary market sales on tickets. Easy, done, do it. You know, that makes a lot.
Yeah. And I mean, everything, obviously, you know, ticketing wise, and even getting down to the high schools. So I think COVID accelerated this, but now you can't, like, the number of high schools that even have physical tickets anymore, most like, the Ohio State High School Athletic Association this year with the state tournament, there's no ticket sales when you show up. If you're going to buy a ticket, you have to buy it online and just have your phone out, and then the ticket gets scanned when you get there, and then you're into the game. There's no physical ticket. There's no cash sales at the door. It's just you have to buy your tickets pre-sale, or if you show up at the gate and you haven't bought a ticket, well, here's the website. Just go on and buy the ticket, and then we'll get the QR code and we'll scan it and then get in the game. So it's trickling down to high school sports. I'm waiting to show up for my first AAU tournament and pay my $25 for my weekend pass and not have to pay cash for it, just to have it on some app. Somebody's going to figure that out if they haven't already. I'm sure somebody somewhere in the country is already doing that.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be smart. I mean, I've raised this issue with a few other people though, like these AAU tournaments, club, you know, whatever sport really, I'd say basketball, football, like lower, lower economic status, generally speaking, but like baseball, lacrosse, like some of these tournaments now, like they have such a monopoly where it's like you have to go to these tournaments to get seen to play in college. And they charge ridiculous amounts to these teams, these players. I mean, parking's like $50 a week, then it's like $30 a week to get in. And I know that's down a whole nother rabbit hole, but like you just kind of sparked my opinion there where it's like,
honestly, that's a great topic. We're coming up in an hour and a half. This is a great topic to finish on because I think it's something that affects everybody in the basketball space, right? It affects players, it affects parents, it affects coaches, it affects all of us. So dive into a little deeper what the problems are and if you have any thoughts about what could we do to make it better, because I have a huge problem with the same thing that you just talked about. So let's talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe September, in the fall last year, I wrote an article about this, and I saw Perfect Game Baseball, and I mean, I have no problem calling these companies out because they know what they're doing. They were charging like $3,000, $3,500, somewhere in that range, like a weekend for these teams. It's because they have a complete monopoly over the baseball market in AAU, and there's no one really coming in because they bought out all their relationships, and it's like, hey, they've done a good job, like credit to them, and they can keep upcharging because all the coaches go to this tournament. But at the same time, it's like, come on, like, are we really for the players now? Like, it's become too much margin over mission instead of mission over margin, where I think a lot of the people that got into these AAU spaces, whether it's just coaching an AAU team or running an AAU tournament or a whole, you know, circuit, it was about the players, right? Let's get the players seen. Let's get coaches better players. And then slowly it's become all about the money. But I think that's where it all starts, is just kind of the money and the greed behind it, where it's like, hey, these parents are willing to pay for it because if they can get a free, you know, education for their kid, like they're gonna keep paying it even if they don't have the money.
But the problem is, and this is where I think that you run into the issue, is sure, there is a group of players who are playing AAU that have an opportunity to maybe play basketball at the next level. Now, the percentages of players who are playing AAU that are going to go on to play Division I basketball are really small, really, really small. Same thing when you think of Division II, you think of Division III, you think of NAIA. It's still a small percentage of players who are playing. And then there's a whole other group that, if you go back pre-AAU, you go back 20 years ago, those kids, 5th, 6th, 4th, 3rd, 8th, those kids weren't playing travel basketball. They were just playing maybe in their local community rec league. They weren't playing AAU. But now AAU used to, when it first started, it used to be more of the better players who were playing AAU. Now AAU is everybody. So it's one thing if I have a high-level high school player and I'm going, I'm playing the tournament and there's college coaches there and whatever, and I'm having an opportunity to be seen, just like we talked about off the top, right? You have to go and get that exposure. But if I'm a fifth grader, there's no college anywhere. No matter what bill of goods people are trying to sell you, there's no college anywhere that's looking at, considering, talking about watching fifth grade basketball players. And yet, there you go, unless it's LeBron's kid. But they're just, the amount of money that AAU tournaments charge to get in, which I know, look, the gate is where they make most of their money, again, depending on how much they're charging teams to be in the tournament, but the gate is where the money is. But it just seems criminal that the amount of money that they charge. I'm always amazed that people don't bat an eye. Like, there hasn't been a rebellion among parents. And again, at the higher levels of high school AAU, I get it. But at the lower levels, if you have a fifth grader and you have two parents and a sibling that are going to watch this kid play over a weekend, and then you're traveling out of town, which, if there's anybody listening and you're traveling out of town with your third, fourth, or fifth grader, I'm not sure that that's a good use of your money, which is a whole other topic altogether. But it's just, I mean, I don't know what the solution is, but it feels like the solution is better educated parents and everybody kind of rebelling against the system, because the system to me is broken.
Oh yeah. And that's one of the things we're trying to build at AIR. So like everything's been service based in this industry, and we've having gone through it, and James came from Australia. So they basically, you pay money and you it's called Pro Kick Australia, and you kick, you know, you get better at punting, and they literally give you three options and they say, pick one of these schools. Like there's no, like it's a true service, and like you have very, very little say. So he has that international perspective, and the amount of international kids that want to come to America to play in college is absurd too. I don't think people realize that. If that becomes easier, there's going to be even less spots and it's going to become even harder and harder. But like we've taken the platform approach and we're just trying to bring like complete transparency and make it free for everyone. And like, yeah, we have to make money somehow. So it's like some premium offerings where you have greater visibility to stuff. But like overall, it's like we're not selling anything. We're not selling a recruiting service. We're not selling a camp. We're not selling training. Like we're bringing you all those options to the table and say, hey, you can pick here. Like you're from Carolina and these are the three best camps, or these are the three AAU tournaments this weekend. Like, listen, like we don't have control over this. We're not selling you on it, but you know, providing that platform where now kids and athletes and the families can get in contact and they can at least promote themselves right, where it's not like paying a service $3,000 to just email their highlights, where it's like you can actually display yourself the best way. So it's like what we're trying to build at AIR in short. But to your point, like the system's broken and we realize that, and it's in need for disruption heavily. And it really does. It starts with the parents, but the problem is if all the coaches are going one place, like
that's where the kids are going
to
be.
Yeah. It's hard to rebel against that. It's bite your tongue. Hey, I hope, you know, this 50 extra bucks like pays off. But I mean, now with all the crazy inflation and gas prices, I mean, I feel for people that are about to go through it this spring and summer. I generally feel for those families, and I hope that, you know,
yeah, I'm jumping into it for the first time. So my son, we've always just kind of played local, and he's in 10th grade, just finished up his sophomore year. And this is the first year we're going to kind of jump into it a little bit more and go and travel a little bit, not nationally, but just travel. You know, we're here in Cleveland, Ohio, so we're going to probably travel to Pittsburgh and travel to Indiana, maybe go to Louisville. But yeah, you start looking at it, you start adding it up and party. Yeah. You just look at it, you're like, man, it's time. Unfortunately, you kind of have to, you can only fight the system for so long, and I've tried to fight it for a while, but I still continue to be amazed though that people who have a third or fourth grader and you show up and it's like $25. I can't believe the number of people who just walk right up and whip out their wallet and drop $25 to get in for the day, and they don't even bat an eye, or like I'd at least make a smart aleck comment because I was paying. You know what I mean? If nothing else, and I know the person who's collecting money at the gate isn't the person who's making the money, clearly, but still, it just feels like. And then the thing that I love is when you go and you paid your $25 to get in, and then you get the score key too. Besides, that's even better.
Yeah, and then they sell the coaches the $300 pieces of paper booklets that has all it has is kids' names, and that's it. It's like, right. How do I find them? So
right, that's really beneficial.
Yeah.
Well, it's definitely the wild, wild west out there when it comes to AAU basketball. And I think there are a lot of people out there doing it right. So not to paint a broad picture that it can't be done right, but unfortunately, there's always bad actors out there that are doing things that aren't in the best interest of kids and aren't in the best interest of the families of those kids and aren't in the best interest of the game. And ultimately, I think that's where I hope it goes. I hope it goes towards whatever we do. Like, I don't begrudge anybody the right to make money from running a business. And I run a basketball business and I make money from the basketball camps that I run. So I get it, but you also have to do it with the right intention and make sure that you're doing it in such a way that there's benefits to the people who are participating and not just benefits to the bottom line of the tournament operator. Unfortunately, that's where you get sometimes.
No doubt. No doubt about that.
All right. One final question before we get out, Andrew. I want to ask you where you see yourself going over the next couple of years, and what direction have you thought about the direction that you want to take your entrepreneurial spirit, where you want to go. Just give us an idea of what you see on the horizon.
Yeah. And I'm always been a fan of, and I'll share brief, like short answer formulas, but I've always been like a believer in like not putting it out too much. Cause they always say like, if you put out like what you want, sometimes like you, I don't know, there's some saying about like, but so kind of where I see myself in general is like, I really want to get air to an international play where we're helping kids all around the world and we're giving them the tools to come to America if they want, but also to find club and pro opportunities in other sports. And then eventually we can build it up to where an athlete maybe gets on when they're 13 and they can get AAU events. Then they get to, you know, the next stage, which is college. And then they go to they can find pro opportunities and then sign brand deals, et cetera. And then personally, eventually down the line, I want to work more in tune with athletes, hopefully more in the financial aspect. If that comes to be, or definitely some media plays. I'm trying to work on some things to have sort of a media component where I can interview, and I was talking about this earlier, the peak performers, getting athletes on and just giving back to the younger generation. We're talking to these athletes that have been really successful and gone through it is kind of where I see myself from the lens business-wise. But like you and me both know, and Jason knows, we're not what we do, right? Basketball, business, it's only teaching, writing. It's only a portion of us. There's a lot of other areas of life that I want to get to and see myself doing in a few years as well.
Absolutely. That's well said. And I think it kind of sums up the way that our conversation went. We touched on a lot of different things, went in a lot of different directions. And it's a lot of topics that we talked about tonight that we haven't necessarily hit on the podcast. And so it was really interesting, I know, for me and for Jason to be able to hear some of the things that you're doing and talk some NIL and talk some NFTs and just talk about the whole process of basketball and business. So before we get out, let people know how they can connect with you. Obviously, share your Twitter, share how people can subscribe to the newsletter, whatever other social media or website, whatever you want to share, and then we'll jump back in and wrap things up.
So first off, obviously, Jason, Mike, thanks for having me on. But for everyone listening, you can find me at Andrew Pekesh on Twitter. I kind of run everything through there, my newsletter. I answer all my DMs too. So if anyone has any questions or wants to chat, you can kind of go from there. And, you know, I try to, that's like my social profile. They say it's like the new LinkedIn, or it doesn't matter if it's business, sports, whatever, it's kind of go to Twitter.
Absolutely. That's where we spend most of our time. And I think it's been helpful for us for sure. And I know that you built up a nice following. And again, if you have a chance to subscribe to Andrew's newsletter, make sure you do that. It's very well done. And there's a lot of interesting things. He brings a perspective that you may not see in other places. So it's really well done, Andrew. And again, we can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on with us, talk some basketball, talk some business, share your basketball journey with us. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.